Welcome. Thank you all for coming on this very hot afternoon. My name is Sarah, and I'm one of the editors of Triple Canopy. We organized this event today as part of our ongoing series called Speculations, The Future Is. It's 50 days of lectures and discussions where we've invited artists, writers, activists, technologists, to think about the future and then describe what kinds of demands that future might make onto the present day. So, oh, thank you. So, coming up tomorrow, we have Ray Brassier, who will be describing what the future is and how we might orient ourselves toward it. For those of you who don't know, he's one of the he's part of the speculative realism movement, although he might not identify himself that way. But and then this coming weekend, we have Natalie Jeremijenko and Agnes Den on Sunday, but watch out for possible schedule changes. But today, I'm very, very pleased to have with us Silvia Federici. Silvia is a professor emerita of political philosophy and international studies at Hofstra University. And she's also an activist, a teacher, and a writer. In 1972, she co-founded the International Feminist Collective, the organization that launched Wages for Housework. And she has worked on the anti-globalization and anti-death penalty movements. Her books include Revolution at Point Zero, which was published in 2012, and Caliban and the Witch, Women, the Body, and Primitive Accumulation. And I'm really honored to introduce her today and to have her here with us. So thank you, Silvia.
Good evening, and it's good to continue the conversation with some of you after the discussion we had before, and welcome to the others who braved the weather. And I want to thank, first of all, Sarah Resnick for having invited me here. This sounds a very interesting program. Although I must say that the task that we were assigned, at least for me, it was a very formidable task, and is one that I'm not sure I can accomplish to all your satisfaction, although I'm going to try. Because to imagine the future, particularly from the rubbles of the present, the kind of devastation, social, ecological, economic, that we are witnessing around us is definitely a very formidable task. And also, politically, I'm not inclined to speculate into the future because I understand that the process by which we bring about the future, the process by which we realize or try to realize our political dreams, transform ourselves and also transforms those dreams, opens up a whole different areas of possibilities that we had not imagined. So rather than an image of the future, I will try to speak to some of the principles that guide my imagination. And adding right away that these are principles that are not my own. are not principles that constitute a kind of private dream, but they are principles that I gather, you know, from the movements all around me. In fact, I would imagine that what I present tonight, or at least I hope so, is something of a common sense, is something of a common notion, because I think that my words, you know, will reflect ideas and desires that are very much part of the collective imagination today. Now, the image of the future, of course, that I have and that I try to realize, you know, is an image of a society in which we'll finally have social justice, you know, in a society where people's needs and desires will be met, a society that will be ecologically sound, and where the wealth that is available to us, all around us, instead of being destroyed and being subordinated to the profit motive, will actually be put, you know, at our disposal in a way that regenerate us, but also regenerate the environment in which we live. Now, among broad circles of people, feminists, ecologists, and all kinds of rebel subjects, indignados, disobedience, you know, this image in recent years has concretized in the image of a society of commons, you know, which is, in a nutshell, you know, a society in which people share the available resources, in which the dominant relations are relations of solidarity rather than competition, and where, in a sense, you know, the goal of production, the goal of every activity, is the common good. And ultimately, the goal is the formation of a collective subject, or collective subject, but certainly of population who find that their identity is really part of a broader reality than their own individual life. And from being part of this broader reality, they gain their strength, they gain their power, and they gain their capacity of resistance. Now, this may all seem as a very nice dream, but it's something more than a dream. In fact, the idea of the common, the notion of the commons, which now, you know, circulates very vastly, you know, portrays something that already exists. You know, first of all, for most of humanity's time, for hundreds, if not thousands of years, you know, human beings have organized themselves on the basis of commons. That is, on the basis of society in which you were born into social regime, social situation, where everybody in the community had access to the natural wealth and other wealth produced available. So most people in Africa, Latin America, across the continents, lived in society organized as commons. And even today, you know, there are still many parts of the world, you know, where commons is one of the fundamental forms of existence. Just one example is the Ailu system that you have in the Andes, which is really one of the oldest social realities in the Andes and still continues. In fact, there are now many studies of the Sistema Ilu, means family, clan. And the Ilu system is one where people, in fact, are tied, are co-owners of land, and are tied by a whole system of reciprocity, in the sense that, you know, it's a very highly cooperative system, that every kind of work, any important type of work that people need, you know, can rely on the collaborator of others. And then, of course, that collaborator is reciprocated. And this has generated also an attitude towards the natural world, which is also an attitude of reciprocity, that if you take from nature, you also have to give back. And of course, this has also been very much part of the cultural tradition of the Native American people, you know, in North America, that you don't only take from nature. So that the notion of the commons implies a notion of sharing, implies a notion of joint use, implies a notion of reciprocity, and not only entitlements, you know, but also obligation. Obligation to other people, obligation to the land, and obligation to everything living into the environment. Now, we, of course, are in a very different situation here in the United States, where, in fact, particularly in the last 40, 50 years, right, no effort has been spared, as it has not been spared on the international level, you know, but some cultures have been able to resist it more than other, but no effort has been spared to privatize every aspect of our life. No, this is very much a trend that is now sweeping the world. Right? There is the last phase of capitalism. Well, we don't know if it is the last, but certainly this latest phase of capitalism, you know, is one in which practically there is an attempt to institute a global regime of enclosure, meaning a regime in which we will not be able to have access to anything in the Commonwealth, whether it is a beach, whether it is a forest, whether it is a land, without, in a sense, having to pay a price for it, without having to be exploited, even in a condition in which, in fact, even exploitation is becoming a right, is becoming something that we have to fight for. We now have to find and demand jobs, you know, which means we have to demand the right to work in a dependent condition, in a condition in which we are exploited. So, even though we are in a situation, you know, very different from that of those communities who still are able to live communally, who still are able to have some access to common goods, who are able to still share some wealth, and this is clearly a very important source of power for them. For example, it's very clear that the Ilu system in the Andes, in Bolivia, you know, was crucial for empowering people in the struggle that they made in 2000 against the privatization of land, you know, in the region, the famous water wars of Bolivia, that basically led to massive uprising that lasted almost 3 years, right? owed much of their power precisely to the system of the commons that basically was able to create a circulation of insurrection, a circulation of struggle that actually forced the state to retreat. Right? Now, we are in a very different situation, but nevertheless, the issue of the common is equally crucial for us. Because in addition to the fact that we are more and more losing access to the natural wealth, you know, we are also now, at least an increasing number of us, you know, are in a situation in which all the forms of support for our day-to-day reproduction are being foreclosed. The word that we use is the dismantling of the welfare state, right? That very neat sociological definition in reality implies that whatever support system existed from the part of the state of capital, you know, for our reproduction now is being taken away. And we daily see the consequences of this situation. We see it in the mortality rate, for example, of children. You know, we see it in the level of poverty, right? 50 million people in poverty, and many of them in dire poverty in the United States, which is supposed to be the richest country of the world. 90% of unemployment among some of the youth, at least low-income youth or youth that has no formal education in some of our communities. And massive use of antidepressants and other forms of drug, you know, to ease the pain of living, to ease the anxiety, the sense of despair that people feel when they see that there is no future. In fact, we speak of the future. This no future has been one of the key slogans, has been the slogan of a generation, right? No future. You know, even in the late 70s, when we were working in Midnight Notes, one of the first issues that we produced was called No Future Notes. No Future Notes. So it's a bold step to say that we want to reclaim our future. And so that's what the concept of the commons implies. And that's the way I'm going to use the concept of the common. The first step in unfolding this idea is to say that thinking, moving politically within the horizon of the commons comes from a determination not to allow our life to be foreclosed, right? From a determination to reopen time, to reopen the possibility of the future. And how can we do, you know, what are the steps that we need to take basically the future back to us? Well, I think that the first step that we can take is to realize that many of the elements of the future that I have projected, you know, the kind of utopia future that I projected at the beginning of my talk, are already with us. Although they are not completely visible, you know, they are growing in the interstices of capitalist society, in those places where the state is completely absent and people need to create something, you know, moved just by the need to survive. or in those areas in which people are determined from the here and now to change their life, and they are coming together to experiment with different forms of living in the way in which, for example, in the same ways in which, for example, in the 60s, you know, you had across the country and in many parts of the world a whole movement of communes. There was precisely a movement of commons in many ways, for all the limits the movement had. You know, nevertheless, it was probably the first movement in the 20th century, at least in the United States, to really shake in a very fundamental way, right, the fundamental element of social reproduction. The only other movement that was even more powerful than that being the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement. Both together have shaken really the fundamental of capitalist society in the United States. And in that way, this is one of the reasons they were also very, very powerfully attacked, even though in different ways. So those elements of commons are around us, and we need to be able to see them. In other words, there are, in fact, many, many forms of commons that have not been completely destroyed, and others that are being daily recreated. You know, one example is how the internet has generated many forms of communication, any form of commonality. Although I would say that we need to place, you know, the technology on the internet also under scrutiny before taking the step that many have of proclaiming that that is a common. Now, I thought of what I would do. You know, I sat for a few days in preparing for my presentation today, right, trying to imagine, you know, what would be the world of the common tomorrow here in New York. Sarah had encouraged me to do. And of course, I always came in conflict, you know, with the fact that in order to imagine that society, in order to imagine that ideal, I had to block out entire realities. I had, in a way, to imagine that, you know, like the hero in Bellamy's Looking Backward, I had somehow gone into a long sleep, and lo and behold, when I woke up, the state had disappeared. Right? Capitalism had disappeared. And in a way, the bounty of the world was there for us to reorganize. Right? Was there for us to rethink, to reorganize. And so let's dream a little bit together. Let's dream a little bit together and see, like, what would happen? What would be the world like, and what we could do if, in fact, we had the dream and we woke up, you know, with a nice, clean slate, at least clean of the two main agents, because the slate would not be clean. The slate would not be clean. And when we look at the future, let's say a future clear of these huge monsters, capital and the state, which have on their credit the life of millions and millions of people, once the slate is clear, we still find ourselves an immense task in front of us of regeneration, reconstruction, because we will find ourselves in a very devastated planet, devastated socially, and devastated economically, ecologically, where in fact almost every part of the Earth, of the planet, of the environment in which we live is poisoned and booby-trapped. So the first encounter with our ideal future, it's a reality shock that tells us that in front of us, and of course from the future, we can extrapolate into the present, right? This is the kind of exercise that we need to do. We need to imagine a kind of experiment of reality, you know, under control, in a kind of a controlled experiment, and then extrapolate what does it mean for us today, tomorrow, right? We are going to be in a situation in which just to regenerate our environment, the work will be immense. The work will be immense. Think of it economically. Think of it economically, right? For at least half a century now, even to look at our recent past, not to look at the history of capitalism as a whole, but to look at our recent past, right? Much of the work on which our day-to-day life depends, our clothes, our shoes, our food, our mic, probably, much of this has been externalized. Right? Everything has been exported not only to a neighboring region, but it's been exported to another country, right? Or to another continent, in many cases to another continent. What does it mean? What is the work? Right? So in the future, there will be an immense amount of activity, right, to, in a sense, weave back an economic fabric. The work of weaving back a new economic system, a system where, for instance, production, consumption, and distribution are not completely scattered through the world, and they are not assigned to completely different populations who have no notion of each other and have no conception of the consequences of what they consume, of what they produce, of what they do to the life of other people. Right? So this is definitely something that we have to think when we look ahead and think what is the future it confront us with. You know, also we will have, of course, to, as I mentioned before, regenerate ecologically our planet. And we will also have to submit every form of technology that we use, right? This, I think, is very important. Is the future going to be a technological future? What kind of technology, for instance, is going to come with us, right? What will be, how can we imagine that, let's say, how we'll imagine the society 50 years from now, if we had our magic wand, right? If we have a magic wand, how do we imagine technologically, right? Well, the first thing that we can imagine is that we will have to have, you know, committees of commoners. One of the tasks of the commoners will be, in fact, to submit to a revision, a major revaluation, the technologies in use. Because many of those technologies, you know, who seem to bring us some benefit, are in fact obtained through the destruction of the commons of other people across the world, though we don't see it now. As, for example, it is the case of the computer. There is a whole work that will need to be done on, for example, rethinking the telecommunication technology and digital technologies of our time. Because we know now that under present condition, there is a very direct code, a very direct connection between digital and communication and other communication technology, and, for example, the wars in the Congo, and, for example, the kind of massacres that have been taking place, which have taken the life of millions of people in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, at the roots of which, clearly, there has been the attempt to force, you know, a clearance, force populations out, you know, from areas that are extremely rich in minerals, that are extremely rich and are rich in all those minerals that, for example, in the United States are called strategic, which means they are essential for the production of the main technology on which this system is feeding. Right? So we will not be able to say, okay, let's have a technological fix, right? That we, in a sense, can clear, you know, can open the doors of paradise for us and clear for us the mess that capitalism has created over a century of devastation. Also, the work that will be ahead of us will be very important because, and here I begin, want to begin a theme that is very, very close to my heart and my political work as a feminist. When we begin to think of work, not simply as production of goods, production of material objects, or even production of cultural goods, but when we think of work as production of people, and we include in work all those tremendous amount of activity, very, very crucial activities, you know, that are necessary for the reproduction of life, of individual community, beginning with domestic labor, beginning with procreation, because without procreation, we wouldn't even have a new generation, right? And domestic work, housework, you know, all child raising, the care of the elderly who are not self-sufficient, the care of the children. When we project that into the future, right, we will see also that a revolution will have to occur in the organization of work, because today these are the activity to which more and more less attention is given. We are in a situation now in which the space, the time, the energy, the resources, you know, that go into sustaining our reproductive activity is continuously drained, is continuously taken away. Not only in forms of services, but also in terms of time, in terms of energies that people have to dedicate to their family, to dedicate to their children, to dedicate to their friends and their communities. People hardly even have the time to talk to each other. You know, stories are that in the American family, Saturday breakfast is the time of greatest coming together. Because particularly in the presence of small children, right, you know, people take turn in working outside the home. So, given this picture, one conclusion that we can come about life in the future, what the future will look like, right, what life in the common will be, one first element that we can solidly grab is that certainly life in the common will see the elimination of alienated labor. The alienation of eliminated labor, because given that capitalism has disappeared, given that the state has disappeared, you know, we will be working for our common good, right? And the production of goods, the production of human being, will be for our happiness and not for the accumulation of wealth in private hands, right? Now, so alienated labor will be eliminated, but more very possibly work itself will be expanded. In other words, in the society of the future is not the society of the end of work. I want to stress this because for a long time, utopias have circulated, including in the left and including in Marx. Think of Marx, I don't know how many of you have read, for example, those last chapters in the Grundrisse, right, where Marx has this very utopian vision. It's very doubtful whether he stood with it for a long time. But he has this vision, right, of a world in which basically with the expansion of industrialization, the machines have taken over everything. Basically, the machines are doing all the work, and human beings are, in fact, present only in the work of supervisor, right? And I don't know about you, but when I was in the 60s and in the 70s, all around me, in political circles, I've traveled many political circles, all around me, many, many people had that dream, right? For example, in my generation, another author that we widely read, Marcuse, Herbert Marcuse, a famous The Essay on Liberation, right? It's a vision of a future in which exactly technology, for the first time in history, that's what Marcuse said, will liberate human beings from the enslavement, you know, to work. And for the first time, our energies and creativity will be expressed. Well, I do not share the dream. I do not share the dream for a number of reasons. First of all, as I mentioned before, because the immensity of the task that will be in front of us, right, and the fact that we inherit a very booby-trapped technology, you know, a technology that we'll have to take with great care, because in many cases it's more destructive than constructive, right, already puts a very different places, these utopias, in a very different perspective. But also because I believe that once the finalization of work to the accumulation of wealth is removed, that if we are in a society in which the activities in which we engage to reproduce ourselves, to produce our life and care for the environment, and finalize to our common good, if we are in such a society, then work will not be as painful as it is today. In fact, that the pain of work will be removed, and we will be in a situation of actually beginning to discover the creative potential of work, even of forms of work that have for a long time been considered as drudgery, as certainly much of domestic labor has been. In other words, I think that looking into the future, we need to realize and we need to keep very much present in our mind that what makes work so oppressive and so exploitative today is to a great extent not the nature of the work itself, but it's the social relationship that sustains this work. And this is very important because, again, you know, notions such as refusal of work, the workless society, you know, have become very much part of certain collective revolutionary imagination. And I think we need to revise them. Very important, in my view, is that if we think of the work of the future in as an ideal society, then we'll think of a way, a place, a site where work will be reinvented, reconstructed, and where we will have, which I think is very, very crucial, you know, also projecting the future back into the present, where we will have, in a sense, an inversion of value, in the sense that, you know, the work that is being considered most devalued in our society, for example, reproductive work, will in fact take the center stage, will in fact be given the priority and the concern that in fact it deserves, being the work that produces our life. Right? In other words, looking into the future, I think we can project, you know, a whole set of transformation that the work process and activity of work will undergo. Right? Now, it seems to me that in order to have a society of commons, the first requirement, you know, that makes work truly cooperative and truly creative, is first of all that the hierarchies, divisions that have characterized the division of labor in capitalism disappear. In other words, one transformation that work will undergo or that we have to struggle for is to make work truly egalitarian activity, which means that everybody will have to share in the most fundamental aspect of work. Everybody, for example, will have to share also on a rotating basis. There are many ways in which we can imagine a division of work in a socially just society, but certainly we can think we have to struggle for a society in which the kind of hierarchy, the kind of division of ranks that today characterize the sexual and social division of labor are eliminated. Right? And how do you do that? How do you eliminate those divisions? One of the ways they eliminate it is by organizing work in such a way that every able person is participant at all level in the reproduction of the community. So cooperation means, first of all, full participation. And here, too, I think that we can look forward to such a change, not as an imposition, not as a limitation on the future as an ideal, but actually as an important revolutionary transformation in our life. When I think of the future society as a common, to me, what stands out, one of the first things that stands out, not certainly the only one, but one of the first things that stands out, you know, is the fact that for the first time in a long, long way, we may be in a position to regain control over our everyday life, everyday reproduction, and be cognizant of what are the requirements of our reproduction, right? Let's think about it, right? Let's think about it. You know, Henri Lefebvre, you probably know Henri Lefebvre is a French sociologist that wrote much about the everyday life in the 40s and the 60s and then even the 70s. In fact, he popularized the concept of the everyday life. He wrote pages and pages about, in fact, he was one of the first who was somewhat critical of the notion of the welfare state, right? He saw that the welfare state was a working class victory, or at least partially a working class victory that came at the end of many struggles, right? But he also looked back at another time, and he has very powerful pages that I've reread in recent days. Powerful pages where he says, but what happens to us with the welfare state, right? Before the welfare state, right, we used to have neighborhood organization. We had, for example, working class organization like unions who did everything. They were rooted. They were very much part of the community. And people basically knew how their reproduction was organized. No, they took care, they organized issues around health. If you had a work accident, this organization would provide some support. The pensioners, people who were older, workers who were not working any longer, the unemployed, the union would come in. And also people may have a piece of land that they would cultivate. There was an engagement with one's reproduction that was much more extensive. And people knew, in a way, what were the fundamental conditions of their life. Also, people had a relationship with the natural world, right? In other words, people knew something about nature, about the winds, about the rains, about the seasons, about the herbs into their garden, the properties of these herbs. And this was also a power, not only in terms of knowledge and information, but also in terms of feeling connected with a whole much broader reality that in a way extended the powers of their body, that in a way made them realize that even the injustices on earth, you know, are part of something much more complex, so that the existence of this natural world around them encouraged them to think, you know, beyond. Right, to think beyond. And he compared, you know, the life that had proceeded with full industrialization, regimentation of life, consumerism, the welfare state. So looking into the future, I see that one fundamental way in which work will change, even if in some fashion, right, that work may increase, which we don't know, but may temporarily increase, even if we don't know. But at the same time, this will give us the possibility to regain control, you know, over the process of reproduction, understanding what is most necessary, you know, for the conditions of our existence. Right? Now, what will be? What will be reproductive work, you know, in a future ideal society? I said before that we will have to have an inversion of value, right? In the sense that it is the productive work has always been the value. Not because we're not important to capitalist society, but certainly because it was so important. The productive work has been so important to capitalism that they had to control it, they had to make it invisible, they had to declare it not work, right, in order to be able, in fact, to obtain it for free. In the same ways that capitalism has appropriated for free so much of the natural world, right? But what we look forward to, and at least this is the world I like to see realize, it's a world in which, in fact, what used to be devalued will be valorized, will be, in fact, at the perhaps consider the most important work in society. But that work, too, will be transformed. I think that once we liberate reproductive work, you know, from the constraints that are on it today, that reproductive work has to reproduce not only life, the individuals, the community life, but has to reproduce human beings as workers, has to reproduce human beings as part of a work machine, once that activity is liberated in that way, then we see a whole creativity will become possible. A whole creative dimension of that work will become possible that today it's obfuscated by the regimentation that is imposed on it, precisely by the task, by the subsumption to the needs of the capitalist organization of work, right? In fact, I imagine a society in which reproductive work, care work, will be not only the reproduction that caters to the necessities of life, but most fundamentally begins to be seen as what it really is, that is producing a new society, producing a new type of individual, right? Producing a new type of subjectivity. In other words, the moment you begin to change, to transform, right, the notion of what reproduction is about, the moment you move it away, right, from housework, from the cleaning of the floors, right, from the cooking and so on, not to disparage the work. In fact, the work itself, it can become very creative. Because in a moment in which the work is organized, you know, on an egalitarian base, on a cooperative base, even the work that appears solely physical can actually be a moment of great sociality. But the cooking, the food production, the cleaning is only one aspect of reproduction. I think we will be able to see that when we speak of reproduction, when we speak of a care work, what we're speaking about, it's also fundamentally, right, the creation of a new world, the creation of a new type of human being. And much of the work we will need to do, and I think is extremely creative work, is working to imagine what kind of society we want to produce, what kind of human beings we will want to produce. And I think that a good example of the transformation that I'm referring to, you know, comes when we look at the question of childcare. Right? For those of you who were with me in the discussion period, you know, with spoke a lot about the fact, or I spoke about the fact that, you know, in the period between the Civil War in the United States and the 1930s, there was a whole debate taking place, you know, about the question of women's work, motivated by a whole population of white middle-class families, right, who were aspiring to a more liberated life. They wanted to work outside the home, and they were looking, of course, at housework as a drudgery, and they promoted a kind of movement. You know, they stimulated a kind of cultural revolution, you know, that basically produced new ideas about the home, family, architecture. But, and of course, at the center of this revolution was the question of childcare. Get the kitchen and the children out of the home, right? In a way, part of their solution to the question of housework was to create public spaces, cooperative spaces, in which cooking, cleaning, and child caring could be organized collectively. Now, I think that that's a very important step. You know, one major mistake and limit of this material feminist was that they assumed that in these cooperative spaces, it would be other women who would do the housework, right? But certainly, you know, the kind of revolution that they imagine, the kind of redesigning of the home, of the that they imagine, making reproductive work more cooperative, more collective, certainly something welcome and something that I would like to project into the future, you know? Certainly we need a whole revolution around reproductive work so that if we can daydream about what reproduction would look like, we certainly can imagine that it will have, you know, many, many, many spaces, you know, that a whole new production of space will be required, allowing for more cooperative relations, right? Allowing, for example, for people caring for cinque in a cooperative way, you know, kitchens organized in a co-op, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that as important as these transformations are, they will have a limited effect. They will have a very limited effect. Is at the foundation of this transformation, we don't also place, right, a transformation in the concept of what it means to raise a child, what it is to raise a child, what is involved in the process of raising a child. That is not something about diapers, is not something about clothing, is not something about disciplining, or is not only about clothing, only about disciplining, is not only about feeding and stimulating a child intellectual. It's also continuously thinking, you know, about what kind of society we want to produce. Is in a sense to rethink every dimension of our life and evaluate if this is the kind of human beings that we want to bring into the world. That child raising, the problem of child raising is not to find a parking lot where we place our children so that we as adults have more space. Or even providing a more extended family, which certainly is desirable because children will have a whole different level of security and sociality if they are part of an extended family rather than being part of a nuclear one, in which the demand on each member, you know, is so excessive that they become a cage, a place of suffocation, right? But really, raising a child is involve a whole process of rethinking what it means to create a new society. I was in La Paz 2-3 years ago and visited this incredible social center, which is called the Virgin of Desire, which is the Virgin of Desire, which was set up by Mujeres Creando, which is a feminist, anarchist, women's organization, very well known in Bolivia. And the center itself, for me, is a kind of model, and it's something that I'd love to see in New York. You know, this is a whole huge building. They call it a reproductive machine, right? A reproductive machine because every part of it, it's a place where reproduction is taking place on a different level. You have the restaurant. You have the garderia, which is where the children are taken care of. You have the computer room. You have the library. And you have the clinic, the legal clinic, where women can walk in and ask advice, like my husband has beat me up, except my boss, except they have the radio, and so you have a constant flow of women coming using the radio. Like, this is something that for us it's an ideal. For us belongs to the ideal future, because in New York we are so far from it. But it would be fantastic to have my ideal future, this type of centers will multiply. Mm-hmm. And we can think of them as whole interconnected, you know, as a way to the society of commons. So I spoke to the women who were taking care of the children, right, of the nursery and beyond. And they said that at first they had decided to have a childcare center because they wanted to be able to liberate women's time, not just time from work, so they could take more work, but time to do other activities. But then, slowly, they realized that a lot more was involved, you know, and they had to begin to basically engage in a whole process of self-education. They realized that the moment you deal with a child, there's a lot that you have to decide. So they began to have meetings with the mothers. Then the fathers joined. So they began a whole discussion about sexuality. What is sexuality? We discover, for example, that we don't know what our sexuality is. Because our psyche, our practices, our emotions are so encrusted, you know, from what capitalism has done to us, that there is so much that we don't know, you know, even including what is our sexuality, what is a sexual desire, what is a proper sexual relation. Mm-hmm. So this, to me, I say at the beginning of this talk that I see elements of the future all around us growing in the interstices of capitalist society. To me, that encounter and that discussion over child raising and a nursery was a small epiphany, was one of those moments in which I realized that this was something very profound and led me to realize that this kind of production will be part of care work. Right? In other words, not only the production of food and clothing and so forth, but the production of a new human being, the production of a new subjectivity, the production of a whole new emotional structure that, for example, begins to heal all the scars that we have accumulated. Right? Because we live in a society where you're continuously made to fear other people. What we are witnessing the last few days is a very, horrible representation of that. And so there is not only a lot of healing and regeneration of the earth, but also of our own social relations. Now, here too, we need also to change and reinvent what it means to be a child, right? Because And the same way, there's a connection with the way elder people are treated in this society. Both are measured in relation to the productivity that they do not provide. The children are not yet productive. The elderly are no longer productive. In fact, the elderly are even more devalued. They are even more devalued because no productivity is expected of them. Right? And so consequently, there is a further devaluation. But children, too, are not seen as full human beings. And I'd like to see a future society, for instance, in which not only there will be social spaces, in which childcare will be socialized, which until now seems to be the peak of revolutionary thinking, but I'd like to see a society that creates social spaces where children can actually control what they do. Copenhagen, in a progressive nursery school, a number of teachers, you know, fought for, I learned recently, for a parliament of children. Right? In other words, they fought to give children a site and a time where they'll be able to say their own, where they collectively, they would be able to decide, this is what we think on this particular issue relating to the school or relating to matters that are important to them. In other words, that there is such a thing as a children's viewpoint, rather than the children only be spoken of through the words of the adult. So, I have to wrap up? Okay, I will soon. I will very soon. As part of the reconstruction of society, as part of this spatial and architectural and social reconstruction, right, in terms of looking about what the future will look like, one aspect of it will certainly be the production of spaces in the homes where children live, and outside of the homes, where actually children can be with each other. Not only to be cooperatively controlled, but instead being with each other and be granted the possibility in that of developing a viewpoint on their own life that will be heard and respected. And, you know, summarizing, I would say a similar transformation of value and revalorization has to be operated with regard to all the people who today, in a way, live materially and psychologically in a very degraded position, precisely because they are those that more and more are seen as having nothing any longer to offer to society. And in fact, you know, the kind of generational war, one of the things that we need to confront today, if we speak of reproduction, is also the generational war that the state is trying to instigate, portraying the elderly as the ones who are destroying all the possibility for future prosperity for the younger generation by consuming, by having the audacity to live so long, consuming the resources that should more legitimately go to the youth, right? And this, of course, contrasts very much with the place the previous society, for example, Native American Indians, gave to the elderly. And I think that here is a place where the future has to look to the past, right? Can learn from the past, from previous culture. Because in those cultures, you know, the elderly are seen as those who are the depository of the history of the community, have the memory of the community, in a sense, living library they are the ones who understand, who know the knowledge, who have accumulated the knowledge. And in that way, I think they stand in very stark contrast, right, with us, the image of the elderly who has Alzheimer, no more memory. It's such an image. Imagine, in so many society, the elderly are the memory of the community. In our society, are those whose memory has been wiped out. They now know nothing any longer. Right? And to move to the conclusion, I think that when we think of care for the elderly, of course we can think of many forms of structures and many forms of home design and neighborhood design that would make the possibility for all the people to have a place, to be visible, to be mobile. But most fundamental, it's important to realize that whatever provision is made and whatever intervention is made has to be one that takes into account the particular condition in which elder people find themselves, where they find themselves in a state in which slowly everything around them, you know, vanishes, where the people that once gave meaning to their life disappear, right? Where they depend on others, you know, for help that many times challenges their dignity. And without this understanding, which of course today is ruled out by the organization of our nursing home, who don't even have the staff to turn a person in bed so that they don't develop sore in their bodies, right? That this is certainly something that a future society will have to make a space for. And I envisage, right, a kind of society in which, for example, the older people will be reinstituted to their position as storytellers, you know, reinstituted to their position, and in a way will not be allowed, so to speak, to go out of this world without first leaving with us their story, without first leaving with us what they have learned in this passage through the earth and in this passage through our communities. So the figure of the older person, a storyteller, is something that I think we need to cultivate. Because it's only by connecting ourselves, and here I will conclude, is only by connecting ourselves, you know, with this broader history of other people, in the same ways as connecting ourselves with the broader reality of nature, that we can actually fully expand and create our powers, and also give a meaning to our life. You know, you find the meaning in the collectivity, never in your own self-enclosed individual destinies. And in this way, we can also give a meaning not only to our life, but also to our death. You know, and looking towards the future, and perhaps because I now place myself among the elderly, and I see myself moving towards the end of my life, that I think that death too should be reclaimed. That death too should be made a common. As it used to be in many societies and for many generations, you know, when John Donne, the 17th century poet, English poet, you know, they gave the name to Hemingway's novel, For Whom the Bell Toll, right? When Donne said, For Whom the Bell Toll, he had imagined a very real reality. He had imagined a community, right? Because For Whom the Bell Toll, there was a bell that was actually ringing, telling everybody somebody died. And this was not the only sign. It was not the only way in which the community was involved in the death of other people. You know, you had the announcements. Even when I grew up, in Italy in my youth, every time somebody died, everybody knew. You know, you had all the announcements on the walls everywhere, listed in black. You had the bells. You had the hearse passing through the community. We may choose in a future society not to use these forms, but what I think it is important, it's also to reclaim as part of our common an experience as fundamental as the experience of dying, not only the experience of being born. And oh, by the way, the experience of coming to the world too has been commonized, as it used to be in previous society. Look at the painting of 16th, 17th century, birth giving, where you see the mother giving birth surrounded by a whole group and common of women, right? So right there, I think we have two fundamental images that even though they belong to the past, now when I think of them in their social implication, you know, seem to be pertaining to a more different temporal dimension and a more revolutionary one. Thank you.
I think we have time for maybe one question or two short questions.
What much time we have?
We just have about 10 minutes. Ooh. Yeah, not very much, because the museum closes pretty soon. So if anyone does have a question, you can come down here.
Yeah.
Sure. We always talking about the kids, but then it's like you, the parents, are the one educating these kids. So you are the one who can make whatever you want from him. But then it's like, what's the background of the parent, where he's coming from? And it's this whole idea of going back and how to make the life of this kid much better. So I think that was a very important point.
So that's this.
What about the elimination, first of all, the decoupling of wages from work and the elimination of the money economy?
Oh, remember, we started after the dream. That was gone. That's the common. The common is beyond the money. But you're right. It's good. It's a triad. I only mentioned two monsters, but there's a third, money. So that's very important. Thank you. We wish them away. Yes.
It was interesting when you spoke about the value of the elderly in society that you used the term consuming, as in the elderly consuming things that the youth should have.
That's the state view.
That's right. It's the state view, but it is a view, and I'm wondering, at what point can we shift from that view, and also shift from the fact that the consumption of products and services is kind of like the daily life. So, does the life change, or does the view change? It's a chicken and an egg question. Which has to happen first before we can stop considering the consumption of elderly people as taking away from the what youth should be consuming, how does the word consuming like change that question? Because it's not just consumption; it's creation.
Yeah, but this is a very artificial division that is created. It's not a real division, because in fact it's setting up a contrast and antagonism, right? So the idea is that there is this very limited part, and basically we have to decide who gets what. And so if all the people get a bit, you know, social security or a particular type of housing for free or et cetera, like the assisted home might be a good concept, and more of those type, and if those ideas should be encouraged. Nevertheless, you know, the view is that this takes away, you know, something from younger generation. Well, so we have to say, no, there's not a limited part. The limited part is, in fact, something the state has created. So there's the idea that every time any part of, you know, the working class, the population makes a gain, somebody else has to suffer. You know, that's one of the most pernicious ideology, and in fact, it's also at the root of a lot of racism and sexism. Yes?
Thank you. I found that interesting because I think it might not only have to do with consumption, but also taking responsibility. I used to work with old people at a hospital, and what really stuck with me was this feeling that many people seem to have difficulties with taking responsibility, even as old people, taking responsibility for and wanting to take responsibility for their lives. So although there is a lot of creative potential in these people, they seem to be pushed into this role of, mm-hmm. as you say, not having to produce or not. And so I found that very interesting. Yeah. What do you think of?
Nothing to contribute.
Exactly, and that is like psychologically seen a very destructive state of mind. And my question is, what do you think of responsibility and old age, and what are your visions of that?
I think that the responsibility, the loss, is a continuous process, right? In other words, we are being disempowered and encouraged to think that we have no powers. So that's what I was saying, that for me, the vision of the common is, first of all, which is beyond the state, beyond the, it's the vision of a place where we reclaim our agency. We reclaim not only the land, the forest, the wealth that we have produced, but we also reclaim our capacity to shape our life and our determination to know what are the conditions of our life and take responsibility for the conditions of our life. You know, today we don't even know, you know, which fields will be polluted by our trash. We know that there's going to be, at the end of our consumption, there's going to be probably a hell to pay for many people, you know, who will breathe the trash, the incinerated trash, right? Now, that is the kind of things that I think we have to project into the future. No more irresponsibility, you know, which means, of course, fighting against the state that wants us to be in that condition. And I see the common. So I've spoken about the common in a sort of detached from, at the moment, you know, projecting it in a, but the question, of course, for us is how do we get there, right? How do we create transitional commons? So to me, those elements that I intersperse in my presentation, when I talk about the Galleria in La Paz, when I talk about the Parliament of Children in Copenhagen, and when I, you know, et cetera, et cetera. To me, these are all expression of the striving that many people, and I know all of you, are making precisely in that direction today. And the challenge for us is how we bring them together, how we make sure that they give each other support, and they reinforce each other, and they network in a way that they can create a new mode of production. They can create a new mode of production and reproduction beyond money, etc. That's for us the challenge today. And also, and the challenge, of course, of making sure that this desire, you know, for a cooperative sociality and for community building, right? For going beyond the isolated dwelling and the privatization of life and all of that is not used against us, is not co-opted against us. So, for example, the World Bank talking about global commons. The global commons, there's no such a thing as the global commons. They are making themselves, for example, representative of humanity. So they are saving the forest for us, which means how they do save them, they give them to companies to exploit. And they think that's the most rational way, right? Or, for example, the kind of gated community that privileged people, white, upper middle class, etc., create, you know, which are not commons because they are community built on exclusion. Right, built on keeping others away, right? So there is a danger there. And it's very important for us to see when we speak of transitional commons and the commons as a political form, right? To make sure that in a way, these are commons that have an anti-capitalist dimension. They can actually be the bridge to a different society, you know, rather than forms that can actually be used to appease, right, the malaise, you know, the sense of pain, despair that the organization of this society creates. So Anna has one. Okay. Another question? Yes.
Hi. So regarding your last point, so some of us in New York right now are actually working to organize workers generally considered reproductive workers. So low-wage nonprofit workers, HHAs, CNAs. And in the course of it, we were reading Wages Against Housework, your piece, and we were reading the critique of feminist organizations that only wanted to organize cooperative childcare, right? And that it couldn't just be to organize cooperative childcare, but to also demand money from the state to do that and to do it on your own. And I'm wondering, now we're in a period where a lot of that work has actually been totally reorganized, right? So it's not so much that women are working at home isolated doing it, but that it's been cooperates, but under capitalism. So you have several children being taken care of by one or two people who are exploited and working low wages. So I don't know how, if you were to rewrite that piece now, you know, but about the way that the situation has transitioned, what are some of the tactical things that you might intervene with?
Well, you know, I still think that the campaign for Wages for Housing was a good campaign, and I still think that that's very valuable because that was never meant as an end in itself. It was only meant as a way of shifting power relations. So it was meant to destabilize a certain type, make invisible a certain type of work, et cetera, et cetera. So in that way, you know, I still think it's very important. At the same time, I now would see that struggle in a much broader way. You know, so to me, the question of the common, for instance, you know, I think it's very important today to have the kind of coming together, you know, by, I think we need a new women's movement, you know, where, for example, at the question of reproductive work, we create new forms of collaboration, you know, not only by women who are involved with, who have children, who have the responsibility of childcare and so on, but also women who are working in the public sector, right? Who are making a big struggle within the public sector, whether you know it is hospital, or whether it is you know people working with the elderly, etc. But I think that we need basically forms of organization, forms of cooperation. Where they bring together, you know, people who are transforming the reproductive work within the community with people who are transforming it and changing and fighting around it in the public sector. And this is, I think, for example, at the end of September, in Philadelphia, there's going to be a big conference by women, by nurses who call themselves rebel nurses. I'm looking forward to that conference because I'm within the nursing. Nurses have been very progressive in the United States. They've been very much in the forefront of reproductive struggles. You know, it's been one category of women's wage worker that have really made a big contribution. They're always there in many, even in the Occupy movement, they had a very significant presence. And they are nurses who are fighting for social justice, the rebel nurses. They believe that they don't want to be in the situation that they know is going to wait for them, where they will have seen that people need care and they will not be able to provide it. You know, it's like today, you know, the reproduction, the struggle about reproduction in a nutshell. You cannot be a good mother without making a struggle, right? Today, you cannot mother without making a struggle because you cannot provide everything. There's such an assault on the necessities of life at all levels that to reproduce is to struggle. And the same thing is for nurses. They cannot do their work unless they engage in a struggle because otherwise they will be in a situation where they will be made, as already is happening every day, particularly with AIDS in the hospital. They will be between the patients, the family of the patients, and the hospital, and they will be the one who will be made responsible when people are given their own medicine, when you know a leg is broken, when bed sores are going to show up, not the hospital or the state that is cutting the funds, right, and is transforming the nursing home, for example, into really concentration camps, but in fact, you know, they are now like teachers. They are on the front line. People who are engaged in reproductive work today are on the front line, right? Continuously seeing a need that they cannot provide for. And this is something that, you know, we have to deal. And I think when I was beginning either in this lecture or in the discussion, speaking of the need of a new movement, feminist movement, not only women, but feminist movement, on the question of reproduction, right? Bringing together all the different agents who are crucial on the terrain of reproduction. We need a new type of mobilization, you know, because we are at point zero, you know. I wrote a book that has that title, The Point Zero. Point zero is that so much has been stripped away, you know, from that process. And that, in a way, we are forced into inventing new ways. Because the old ways are not even there. Good or bad that they were, the old ways are not there. And and of course, in the same process of inventing new ways, we also have to invent ways that we can gain the power to challenge the state so that we can recuperate, you know, the wealth that we have. About childcare. And in fact, what we meant by wages for housework, in the 70s, you know, when you had a very high movement, a very strong movement, particularly on the wake of the civil rights movement, you know, what the civil rights movement was able to do, for example, gave a whole impetus to a lot of people in the communities to basically force the state to actually put some money to finance community-based childcare, right? This was all over New York. Of course, that came to an end when the movement lost the power, and then the money was withdrawn, right? But it was very, very clear. We want the money. We don't want the state to come in and tell us how we organize our children, right? But we want to be able to recuperate because, in a sense, the wealth that so many people have produced is hostage now in the hands of the state. And so there has to be a way in which we liberate that wealth. Not only we liberate our world and our work and we liberate our life, but we also have to take that wealth back. And that requires to build communities of resistance. That is very essential, right? But at the time, those daycare was, okay, we use the money, but you don't tell us. We don't want the state to organize our children. We organize. We decide, right? But the resources have to be there, and they are our resources. I think this is very important that people understand also to that this is not a question of begging the state, it's a question of reclamation. Thank you very much.